Hi, my name's Jack Dempsey, and I'm a drunk, not a fighter. I'd like to thank you folks for having us down here, the committee and all. My wife and I's had a good time. I'd like to thank the committee and you folks for having us down here. I'd like to thank Lee and Pam for everything they've done for us this weekend so far. And I'd like to thank Lee and Zara for a nice ride from St. Louis up here. And I'd like to thank Lois for a free pack of cigarettes. And it's been nice down here. I talked to a lot of drunks while I was down here. Don't seem you need one all that bad from Pittsburgh, you know what I mean? You got plenty of them down here. Plenty of them just as bad, too, it seems. I'm sort of giving you credit for that, you know. In AA, the worse you are, the better they love you, you know. And I always talk about me, the alcoholic. I'm the one that come to the conclusion and had to come to the conclusion that I was an alcoholic, whatever that is. Is there a police car behind me? Jesus, that makes me nervous. God. But when I first come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a feeling, I guess a lot of people have when they first come in here, that you sort of suspect that even though you've had all this trouble with this alcohol, that's not the problem. And somehow you're surrendering to them. Because whoever they are, they've been telling you all your life, if you're like me, that your problem is drinking. And they didn't seem to understand that when I wasn't drinking, I was miserable. I was unhappy. I'd be just standing there just being unhappy. I'd be thinking things like, I wonder how far I could stick a gun up my nose, you know. And they would say things to me while I was thinking things like that, like, see how good you're doing now? You're just fine. You're behaving yourself and everybody's happy. And I was, I'm mentioned in the big book. Dr. Silkworth was talked about. He said people like me are dangerously antisocial. And boy, that leaped out of the big book when I read that big book when I came in here, because that's the way I was. So when I first come in AA and I would listen to all these talks, I got like a feeling that what they were saying up here. See, I listened different when I was new in AA than I hear different things now. But what I was hearing like was that most of the people that talked up here at these podiums were just fine folk. And then they drank too much and they acted like jerks. And they come in here and they stop drinking because of this wonderful outfit. And now they're wonderful again. Just automatically went back to being wonderful. And I wasn't like that. At the very best, I was rotten in my judgment, drunk or sober. And I didn't see where that made a whole lot of difference. Except that when I drank, I acted out more than I did when I was sober. I could think worse things when I was not drinking, but I did worse things when I was drinking. And so everybody was always mad at me. Now, I had this problem about me that I couldn't seem to share with anybody. I told his stories in bars, and I told them to my peers and this and that, and they'd either think I was goofy or that I'd frighten them and they'd run away. And so I just thought there was no use for it. And I wasn't troubled with that stuff when I was drinking. I had to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and listen to some pretty weird ducks before I could understand and identify in here. There's one from California, that Clancy out there. Boy, I heard him. He was an inspiration to me. He stopped that Jack the Slipper business because I had been ready to get drunk, and I just thought somebody was just wonderful if they hated them little old ladies, like he says, slurping up to you, telling you to put the plug in a jug and all that. And that's the way I felt. I didn't like nice people. I hated nice people. And they were like boring and troublesome, and they would help you when you didn't want help. I remember I heard a comedian one time, I think it was Flip Wilson or somebody, said that they were they were going down a highway, and they their license was expired, and they were they had hit and run somebody's mailboxes or something with their car, and they had sideswiped the car, and they were in big like trouble. And their car broke down. They went off the road and went in a ditch, and he's in the ditch. And a nice person come by and puts flares all around his car. You know? Now, flares, you know, they'll draw police just like bugs come around a light, you know? And he didn't want that. And he said, "Did you ever try to blow out a flare?" You know? And that was what I did all the time that I was drinking. I was blowing out these flares all the time, trying to get out from under meddlesome people that had their idea what was right and wrong. Just because 99% of the world agreed, and I didn't take it well when somebody says, "Well, I guess the world's wrong and you're right," you know. And I would say, "Yeah, now you got it. Maybe you're one of the exceptions," you know. And so naturally, I had a hard time in AA. But I want to tell you how I got there, because I was the kind of guy that I could probably address tonight. There's somebody out there, at least. That's why I like to talk in a meeting. There's a lot of people. I have a shy friend of mine, and I respect him. He has a great program. And he says, "How could you talk in front of all, you know, a lot of people like that?" I says, "That's better. If you got 800-900 people, well, there's bound to be somebody out there likes you, you know." You get around 20 of them or something, you might have them to a man. "Jesus, where did this guy get all this crap? You know, how about getting somebody with some sense up here, you know?" So I'm all right with that, a lot of people. I'm nervous. That's all right. I've been nervous all my life. But I want to tell you where I was coming from in those days. Now, when I was about 18 or 19 years old, I was sitting in a bar stool getting drunk again. And I reflected on why my life was wrecked already. 18, 19 years old, my life's wrecked. And the reasons were that I come up with, and I carried all the way through my drinking and into AA, and for a while in AA till AA beat them out of me, was that I was a basket case and a bad person and all that because I had a rotten home life. It seemed like everybody else had a wonderful home life. Everybody else's mother baked pies for them, and their dad rushed home from work and caught ball on the street with them. And they belonged to the Boy Scouts, and they did good in school, and they had a dog named Spot. And they had a sister to beat up, and they didn't have any real trouble with that. I didn't have that stuff. I had a working mother. And my mother worked when mothers weren't supposed to work, you know. And she was a block operator on a railroad, which is like a controller, I guess, in the airports. It was a tough job. It was a little bit hairy sometimes. And looking back on it, and since I've grown up, I know my mother did a heck of a thing, and she made good money. Spoiled me with a lot of it. But I didn't see it that way then. I wanted that mother that was there with the apron on and baking the pies. And so I resented it. And I had a father. My father was a professional bridegroom. He was married 5 times. He had one child, me. And he hung that up, you know. And that's the way I looked at it. And I resented the idea that he had give up on me and kids. And I didn't like that at all. It made me feel different. And I had a grandmother, God rest her soul. She loved me. And I loved her. That sort of raised me. She was weird. She weighed about 300 pounds, and she used to waddle out onto the street among me and my peers. And she would get involved in us. You know, I mean, participate in whatever we were doing and give opinions. And then she would blow her nose on her apron and leave. And I was mortified. I was angry, and I had these mixed emotions that I weren't sure were right. I had nobody to confide in about. I just couldn't tell anybody how I felt, because what I felt I knew wasn't right. I was mad at those other peers of mine for laughing and poking fun at my grandmother, and I was mad at my grandmother for acting like a jackass in front of my friends. And I got self-conscious. I think it is. I don't know whether that caused me to be self-conscious, but I became somewhere along the line extra self-conscious. And I think that anybody that's not self-conscious, they don't understand how painful that is. I would wake up in the morning, even as a kid, in the summer, when I was going to school, and it seemed like I had the awesome responsibility of running my life. It seemed like I wasn't getting any help from this thing, and I was going to go out there, and I wasn't sure whether the kids were going to laugh at me when I did this. I had no concept of where respect came from. I didn't know. I would hear people talk about grown-ups. They would say, well, I respect that fellow. You know, and I thought, what the hell is that? Because I couldn't see any kind of like respect. I didn't understand that. As a child, I guess no young child knows. But I didn't know how to act to get what I wanted. I used to get mad at kids. I remember going to a show and I get mad. There was some kind of thing going on a show, and it was some motorcycles went over a hill, and one guy looked to me like he broke his neck. He was tumbling off this motorcycle, and them kids just laughed at that, and they thought there's, you know, and I'm looking at him and I'm mad at him. I'm thinking, I thought, what's the matter with me? Do I think different? And I remember as a little kid, I was taking a Sunday school, and it was, I guess, during the war. I don't know how old I was then. I was born in 38, but this is probably 1944 or something like that. And I'm in Sunday school, a little Methodist Sunday school. And they were talking about Jesus. And they told the story of Jesus, and they told how he was, when he was crucified. This, I guess it was at Christmas time or something. And so anyhow, I got mad. I got mad, and I said, you know, and they're talking about the Roman soldiers, and they're talking about all this and that, you know, and I remember screaming, if the Marines were there, this wouldn't have happened. And I remember the Sunday school teacher laughed, but, you know, I didn't see it as funny. I can look back on it now. I'd say a little kid saying something, and they were trying to comfort me because I got out of hand. And the other kids were like turning on me and laughing also, and like as if they knew something I didn't know, you know. And like this was an intellectual thing, that if you were so damn stupid, Jack, we could explain to you, you know, why it's all right. Why you make a big hero out of Jesus, and you make a big hero out of the United States Marines during the Second World War, and then when something happens to either one of them, you think it's funny, you know, and I like lost it. And you know what happened to me? I didn't go out, I didn't look any further for anybody to help me with that. I didn't see anybody reach out. I didn't realize that Sunday school teacher had put his arm around me and tried to cool me down. And I couldn't see those things in people's eyes. I didn't understand at that time, and I closed that door inside. I put them out there. Them. They were hypocrites and liars. I was 8 or 9 years old. My mother remarried. I got me a stepfather that was a cross between Archie Bunker and Adolf Hitler. And I wasn't doing well in school and things like that because I was just like on the losing team. You know how you get if you're that kind of a kid. Self-conscious, bored easy. You know, like I didn't want to learn things in school like the capital of Wisconsin or something. I wanted to know why you couldn't stick a cat's tail in a light socket. That's what I wanted to know. And they just seemed to never tell me nothing I wanted to know, you know. And so I shut them down. What do they know? They want to teach you stuff you can't use. And I wasn't that interested anyhow. And I felt like I wasn't that bright. And I just couldn't get involved. I wasn't motivated. So I just marginally got through school. And I guess they took those intelligence tests. And I guess they found out I was a half a notch above an idiot. So they just tortured me into trying better, you know. And that didn't set well with me. I just rebelled against that. I thought, oh, I'm going to get tortured, you know, more. And they'd bring me up there, and I'd be less receptive to their stuff. And I'm just a young kid, and I'm getting cynical. Now I got this stepfather. Now this stepfather made a hobby out of beating the hell out of me. And I made a hobby out of deserving it. And I didn't realize it. And I ended up, by the time I was in junior high school, I was getting in all kinds of trouble. You know, I would do things to get what I wanted. Like I want to buy cigarettes. I didn't have any income, so I forged library passes and sell them. I sold dirty pictures. You know, they got real popular. I seen the kids like them, so I found out where to get them, and I sold them. Now you could see the same thing on Home Box today. I was 35 years ahead of my time. You know. But them stuffy old 50s teachers, they just about lost it over stuff like that. You know. They didn't know nothing about rock and roll, you know what I mean? And I helped bring that in, and that was like the end in my school. I played drums, and I was in junior high school, they put me in a high school band because it was hurting for drummers. And I was undisciplined. I did not like the John Sousa-type marches. I liked something a little bit of funky in it, you know. And so I taught this other drummer how to be just as rebellious. So they were stuck with two drummers that were jiving when jive wasn't popular, you know. And I was getting in all kind of trouble about that. And I had a little band, and our band had to audition for the assembly so we could play there. And so there was a tune that was popular a couple years before that or something that anybody would have recognized in those days, who happened to be square. It was called Mockingbird Hill. And it was a little waltz, and it was so sweet. So I got my band to learn that waltz so we could do the audition. Now, the brand new music that was coming down on some of the black stations that were new up there, that were only operating at about a half a watt because they couldn't get no money, but they were playing the good stuff. And this Night Train was popular then on that station. So we gets up there, and the teachers think we're going to do this Mockingbird Hill, and I tell the boys in the band, don't worry about it. I'll take the responsibility. Let's hit him with Night Train. So this is in 1954, and we hit him with Night Train, and the kids were up on the seats, and the teachers were up in arms. And I, that was the end of my, they didn't want me no more, you know. Now, rock and roll, like, rhythm and blues was going into rock and roll, and it was starting to get big in the country at that time, and everybody that was in charge of everything was angry about it. It was just a lot of crap music that'll never last, you know. Hey, rap on, brother. And so anyhow, I got dismissed from this little high school, and they sent me to a place called Connolly Vocational High School, which was located in the very worst section of the city of Pittsburgh, right across from all the hookers and winos. You had to step over to winos in this little tunnel that went underneath the Pennsylvania Railroad to get to school in the morning from the way I come in. All boys. They didn't want no girls in that school. My mother wanted to go to open house one time down. I said, you're out of your mind, you know. And she pushed me. I took her down there. And some young kid patted her hind end and that, and she was just upset, you know. I said, what do you expect down there? You know, I said, go see the movie Blackboard Jungle. You want to see what's at Connolly. And it was just like that. I remember reading that book later on. I couldn't believe it. This is Connolly. You know, and here that school was in Brooklyn or something, you know. But, hey, Pittsburgh was moving right along, you know. And so this school was sort of like a kickoff for somebody that wanted to go on ahead with crime or something, you know. And basically, they had like two modes of education. You could either get into addiction or crime, you know. And it was mostly, well, in those days, it was mostly alcohol. Well, this is back in the 50s, so here I am, you know what I mean? I guess I'd be in jail if my major was crime. It's not that I didn't do it, you know, but I never thought I was that good at it. And so anyhow, that's where I went. And I met a little girl. Now, this stepfather and I, you know, I want to tell you something. I had the most traumatic experiences with that man. I want to tell you about chickens. You know, I don't know if anybody's knowing about chickens. But I lived in a city, and I didn't know nothing about chickens. And this old man of mine, he drank, and he come home one time with a whole bunch of chickens. I don't know, he must have had 24 chickens. And these crates, he's dragging these crates down out of an old beat-up station wagon. Brings the chickens in the house and tells me, I'm like 13, 12 or 13, kill the chickens. What? You know, like I like chickens. And he starts off to go to bed, and I said, wait a minute, I don't know how to kill the chickens. Well, you better learn, because you're going to kill the chickens, you know. I said, well, I don't know how. And I'm trying to, you know, my lips going, you know, they're lifted, and my eyes are watering, because I don't want to do this, and I know I have to do what he says, you know. So he said, I'll show you how to kill the chickens one time. By damn, you better learn. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. So he takes me down there, he gets a wooden block, he puts two nails in a block, he takes a chicken, stretches his head over there, cuts the chicken's head off with a hatchet, and he goes back upstairs. Now I know how it's done. So I got all these chickens to do now. I don't want to do this, and I feel guilty and awful, and it just seems like a big thing to take something life like that, you know. And So I grabbed a chicken and I put it in there, I chopped its head off. You know, chickens get weird when you chop their heads off. And this chicken gets away from me and everything, and they automatically start stinking a lot. They stink anyhow, but I mean, they really put an effort in when you cut their head off. And this chicken's flying around in there with no head and getting blood all over me, and everything is sticky and sick. I hope everybody's through eating. Yeah. By the way, that was a wonderful meal. You know, I really enjoyed it. But the next chicken I get, now I'm starting to get angry because these chickens are making my life lousy. And I don't want to do this job, and I'm angry, and I displaced anger is just flying out of me like sparks everywhere. Now I got these chickens, man. I'm hitting them. And I'm thinking to myself, what in the hell am I, an apprentice serial killer or what? And I have nobody in this world to confide in about this traumatic experience I'm having here in my cellar. I don't know what, you know, if I told my mother something like that, my mother would, like, get cross-eyed and just look at me. You know, like, just do what the old man says and don't start nothing. That's what my mother would say, because she knows if I start something, then he'll do what I started doing later on. There'll be tables flying and punching the wall and beer bottles and everything. So you don't mess him, don't get him excited. Now, if I went to him and I said, Dad, you know, this is very difficult. Oh, Jesus Christ, kill a chicken, shut up, or I'll beat your ass. It would be as simple as that. You know. And I knew that if I went to Sunday school that next Sunday and told Mr. Farnsworth, the wonderful Sunday school teacher, who I wasn't real sure what he did in his sex life, and I would say to this gentle man that, you know, I got his chickens, he'd say, I never heard of such a thing. Who in the hell's making a young boy like you kill all them chickens? And that's all the further that would have went. Because I knew damn well that Mr. Farnsworth, or whatever his name was, would not go down there and see my stepfather, lest my stepfather would have stuffed him in a one-gallon can and thrown him out the window, you know. So these kind of things weren't going to happen. And I started to get that feeling of hopelessness. And I was this self-centered little kid, and I was sick with all this stuff. Nowhere to vent all this except bad places. Start creating vices and stuff and just doing stuff that ain't. I just felt good when I was doing things you ain't supposed to do. You know, I just felt better then, that's all. What do I got to say to you? You know what I mean? And I would do things that I thought nobody else did. I'd done, in my judgment, the most despicable things when everyone else was acting right. You know? And I felt bad about myself at all times. And I was about 15 years old, and I'm Don Conley in this rotten school. And then when I got bad report cards, I was in a plumbing shop, and I'd get one of the kids in a print shop to give me brand new report cards. And then I'd make up a report card to show him. And I mean, I wasn't stupid. I was slick. You know, I mean, I wouldn't put A's down in there. What do you think, I'm a jackass? I'd put C minus, you know, stuff like that. And I would pass him off, and he'd say, what the hell, why don't you do something in school? You really are stupid, just like I thought, you know. But I could get by with, I could squeak by with that. But one day, I got my regular report card, which was all D's and F's. It looked like a Christmas tree with all that red on there. And got an A in shop. That's what I tell my plumbing customers today. I show me an old report card, you know. They don't ask. That's just what I would tell them. But I got this report card, and I tried to fix it, and the ink ran. I was putting, you know, changing the D's to B's, and it got all over. I ruined it. And I, you know, I can't give that to him. You know, he's never going to buy nothing Mickey Mouse like that. And I know he's going to kill me. He's at work, and he's coming home later on, and I'm waiting. And I'm pacing the house, and I found slow gin in the icebox. I don't know, I guess I had drank something before that, but this is the time I remember. I got that slow gin out of the icebox, and I drank it. And I want to tell you something. I didn't find an answer. I found the answer to that problem. Now, I've been standing up here for about 10 minutes whining and crying about all the stuff that happened to me, and let me tell you, when I drank that slow gin, all that crap went away. just went away, and I made up the expression you've heard today. All right. Yes, I'm going to be all right. And I thought, you know, I'm not only going to be all right now, but I'm going to even do good in school, because I could sit there and listen to that boring crap if I had some of this stuff in me. This stuff is spiritual. And I could understand how people felt that could do dumb things, because I always hated people who had done dumb things. I mean, people are like, when I was a young man, I'd see people working in their yard, and they're planting flowers. I said, what are you doing? Planting flowers. Why? You know, or painting the fence. Why were you painting the fence? You know, don't paint fence. You're 35 years old or whatever. How comes you ain't got a big Oldsmobile convertible out knocking them dead, brother? What are you doing painting fences? You know, and I would go down in front of a church, and there'd be people coming out of church, and they would stop on the steps there on the landing, and they would laugh and talk with the reverend. Ha, 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 ha. You know? And I didn't know what they were talking about. I couldn't imagine for the life of me what you could possibly say to a clergyman that would be even remotely funny. You know? I mean, I could tell them what happened down on the avenue. I mean, what we laughed about was George wrecked his car. He ran over 17 mailboxes before he hit that pole. Yes! You know, and that was George's turn to get it. And you just hope that didn't happen to you on the way home, you know. Because if it did, the next day, it would be, hey, you're what Jack did. You wouldn't believe it. You know, he went in the men's room or something to change his shorts because he had an accident in them. And somebody stole them. He was in there for an hour, finally come out. You know, I mean, stuff like that happens to you when you drink and carry on, you know. And so these are the kind of things that I thought was funny, as long as they were happening to somebody else. And I didn't know how those people lived. But I knew now. I had that booze in me, and I knew that I'd be all right no matter where I was. I found the answer to my life. It's as simple as that. If you understand the feeling I had, you're probably an alcoholic, or you're a damn good Al-Anon, you know. And so, show you the general idea how smart I was. Married at 17 years old. I married the girl I love, my sweetheart, my high school sweetheart. And we started out. You all heard her talk today. I don't know about that stuff she said. That's her perception. You know? All that stuff happened, but I'm a kind of drunk like, yeah, that's right, but listen. You know, you're not a drunk then. And so we started out, and then I started to drink because I knew there was no problem with the drinking had to be incorporated into whatever I did. Everything else was like, well, it's like everything today is like at AA. I'm an AA first, and I can do anything I want. If I want to go make money, I got to work, and I got to do what you do to get money. Work or connive, you know, whatever it takes to get what you want. But I got to do it from some kind of home base. And AA sort of keeps a lid on me doing stuff that could possibly get me in jail. You know, my sponsors say things like, I don't know about that. You know, just try and find another slant on that, you know. And that helps guide me a little bit, because Lord knows I need some guidance, you know. But when I was drinking, I would have guys say, yes, that's a great idea, you know. In a bar, you know, they tell you anything you want. I remember the time I was talking to somebody today about the time and I thought it would be a good idea to join a nudist colony, you know. I said this in the lead one time. A girl came up to me, got mad. She says, I always wanted to join one, and I was 3 years sober before I was able. You know, whatever. But I went down, and I was drunk, and me and another guy, and what I wanted to do was look at them girls in the news camp, you know. I don't think that's complicated, you know. So I went down, and the only way I could get in that gate down there was to tell them I wanted to join. And naturally, they were more inclined to have a family join. And I thought, well, I can get anybody to write my wife's name. I just want this. I don't bring my wife. I don't want somebody to see, look at my wife, some guy like me gawking at my wife. I just want to gawk. See, my wife's not interested in that kind of stuff anyhow. She's a good woman. You know. And so, you know, I went there and I got all the papers for that to sign, and I still couldn't get in. They were waiting for the papers and the entrance fee, so that didn't happen, because I wasn't going to give them my booze money. So I brought the papers home, threw them on the kitchen table, and told my wife to sign them. Now, I didn't remember doing that. But I said, sign these, because I thought maybe I had visions. I was going out there the next morning early, you know. And actually, I forgot about it. I passed out. I was drinking all that day. That's how I ended up there. And I was drunk, and I went to bed, and that was the end of it. And the next, she got them papers and labored with those papers. She thought she was going to have to do one more humiliating thing in conjunction with her crazy husband. And so she did legitimately consider all the possibilities in this and all the negative and positive things. And it was a couple days she was able to tell me no. And I said, no, what? And she says, no, I'm not signing these papers. I said, what papers? And she showed me. I said, I'll throw them away, you know. And here I had put her through all that crap worrying about that. All that time I needed a higher power. I didn't have any. Well, I found Beneficial Finance Company, if that counts, you know. And they helped me out with some of my superficial problems, which I thought were the main problems. My superficial problems were the worst problems in the world. I used to hate the people that say, boy, are you lucky, you know. Like, I remember I got cut at work, cut my finger real bad, you know. I had to get some stitches in. And somebody said to me, boy, are you lucky? What do you mean I'm lucky? I said, well, you're lucky you didn't cut your finger off. I said, you're lucky you didn't cut yours off. I'm the one that got cut. The hell kind of thing is that to say to somebody? See, my perception was different. I didn't understand that. When something bad happened to me, I didn't automatically think, boy, I'm glad it wasn't worse. I'm thinking, why in the hell this happened to me? You know, which I thought was, you know, the way to think. It seemed to make more sense than any other kind of way. But I got on the wrong side of all them by this attitude I had. They didn't understand that when I wasn't drinking, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And nobody wants to feel like that. And I didn't even know that's how I felt until I seen them words in the big book. And I said, no, be damned. This is me. I'm running around showing my wife. She said, I know that. You know? I told my sponsor, here I am. I'm restless, irritable, discontent. He said, you're a real Dick Tracy, boy. Now, he's the one that pointed out to me in there where I'm dangerously antisocial. I pouted for that a couple days. And the only thing that comes good of them things a sponsor hurts you with is you got license to hurt other people with the same thing. You wait for a jerk like yourself to come around and you say, hey, read page, you know, you tell them. And you know they're in there and they'll say, wait a minute, you make me read this, you know. Good for you. You know, that's how I got it. Through AA torture, regular AA torture. I tried to read myself out of this morass I was in. You know, I thought maybe that would help, you know. And I read all the self-improvement books, which alienated me once again from my peers. See, I'm working with other pipe fitters and plumbers, and I'm reading Eric Fromm and Socrates, philosophical stuff, social psychology. During the late 60s, I'm reading books by A.B. Hoffman and Timothy Leary, and they're saying, what are you doing? How about getting these valves put up on your shift, will you? You know, if you want to read something, how about reading the rough end dimensions before you put them flanges in there? Because when I got to follow you up. So I hid it from them, you know. I'd take dirty book covers and put them around Eric Fromm, you know. And I resented that. I remember I would quote verbatim something from Socrates, you know. And they would say, where do you get that junk you're always talking about? And I'd say, it wasn't Socrates, that's you, you idiot. And I'd say, there's just another stupid person in this world, you know, you got to contend with. But the vibes I was giving out, where I was coming from, and nobody would believe I had anything to say. I would stand in front of my wife and quote great philosophy from somebody else's mind, and I'd be standing there with a shirt on with pizza all over it, my zipper open, you know. My wife would just look at me like my mother used to, you know. She would endure me. I hate to be endured. I hate to be tolerated. Never tolerate me. I feel way better if you come up to me and say, will you shut up, Jack, you know. you're just a jerk and you're vulgar and you're obnoxious. I had a pigeon one time that says, we were talking about being obnoxious, and I said, you know, I always, when I first came into AA, I was told that I was obnoxious. I says, what do you think? He says, no, he says, you're above that now. You're overbearing now. That's all right. Somebody got to do that, you know. And so anyhow, I didn't do any good with that. And my wife was dragging clergy in and out of my life trying to help me. And I'd have these arguments with them. And I'm an alcoholic, and I read all his stuff. So I was armed, and I would win the argument with the clergyman and send him packing. And on the way out of my house, he would stop and tell my wife, I'd overhear him, he'd say, I'm sorry, Mrs. Dempsey. Now, I would ponder what he meant by that. I don't know whether he's sorry because he couldn't help her, because she was whining and sniveling back to him about her problems that's mostly her own making because she couldn't keep her mouth shut. Or he was sorry because he wasn't professional enough to fix me. He could fix all those idiots out there, but he couldn't fix me because I was just too smart and sensitive. And I had contempt prior to investigation is what I had, and that wasn't doing no good. Finally, you know,
this is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now for side two.
Through just the way things go, I ended up in front of a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist evaluated me. And you know, before I went to him, I have this alcoholic mind, so I have to make a story out of my reality that'll wash, or that'll get me some help. Now, I knew that if I told him everything I thought and everything I do, that he would bend the rules and have me gassed. And so I wasn't about to tell him that. And I also wasn't about to go in and tell him just a little bit of problems, you know, and then have him say, well, get a hobby next, you know. I wanted some help, so I, like, took some of the package and I dumped it on him. When he evaluated me, he told me I was late in something or other, you know? Now, after I got sober in AA and I look back on it, I believe that if I drank or continued to drink at that time or went back to drinking, that I could possibly be a latent everything. I don't know what would escape me if I was drinking, because I completely lose contact with what you're supposed to do when I drink. And it says right in the big book, and I think Ruth mentioned it, or was it Clara, mentioned that if you take up to that drinking again, you experience incomprehensible demoralization. Now that, in my judgment, isn't walking around with a lampshade on your head at an office party. I mean, that's deep stuff. And that probably includes some of the latent activities some of you think about, you know. And so I was hurt. In the 50s, being latent something was really bad news. That was almost as bad as liking Elvis, you know. And so everything's all right now, you know what I mean? Just ask Phil Donahue. And so anyhow, I go through all this crap, and finally I ended up the worst place I could possibly think of was Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to come here because I had preconceived notions that this place was absolutely full of the kind of people that I always hated. Good people doing good things all the wonderful time and making you gag about it and not letting you do anything that they even suspected might be fun, you know. And I was terrified, but I had to do something because my whole world was coming down around my ankles, and there was no way I could continue this drinking, which was working all that time, and it was not working anymore. And I was getting more bizarre in my behavior and more likely to go to jail and more likely to get put in a rubber room, more likely to kill myself. And so in that mode, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was very surprised about Alcoholics Anonymous, what I found here. It gave me some hope I come in January 1969, and I had my last drink April 18th, 1970. So that left about 15 months there where Reed had mentioned that my home group called me Jack the Slipper. And during that slipping time, I'm here to tell you tonight, if you're a person that suffers from slipping in the beginning of your program, that I didn't want to do it. I wasn't looking around and saying, I can drink now. My sponsor's got his eyes closed. You know, that wasn't it. It was that I was trying to stay sober, and I wasn't armed to stay sober. I wasn't able to stay sober. People that meant well in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, you don't got that first step yet. Well, I'm here to tell you tonight, if you're laboring with that, maybe you're like I was. The first step ain't what's going to do it for a guy like me. Because the first step, they read it at every meeting, but I didn't hear it. I mean, I heard with the words, but what I heard was a message there. We came to believe, powerless over alcohol, our lives are unmanageable. The key in there to a guy like me is we're powerless over alcohol. My contention was then, is now. If you're powerless over alcohol, you're going to drink. You can't not drink if you're powerless over alcohol, and that's what happened to me. I could not drink for about 3 or 4 months, and then I drank because I was powerless over alcohol. The only thing that was going to save me was coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I was a cynical agnostic. And I'm here to tell you that agnostics, there's a lot in AA. They got a whole chapter to agnostics. Ain't no chapter to the sports fans in there. There's a chapter in there to some damn important people, like agnostics and wives, which probably today should read husbands too. And there's a chapter in there to employers. You got to look at them once in a while if you want to eat. And so these important people in my life and important concepts like agnosticism had to be dealt with. At every meeting I was at, they read those steps, and they read, we came to believe that a power greater than ourself could restore us to sanity. That's what they read, word for word. That is not what I heard, as bright as I thought I was. That ain't what I heard. What I heard was, Jack, do you finally believe everything that Methodist minister told you when you was a little snot? I mean, do you believe every word of that Apostles' Creed that they used to all leap up out of their seats and say that thing like it's some kind of only a movie, it's only a movie. They'd get up and they'd say, they would all, to a person in that church, at the top of their voice say, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and His Son, Jesus Christ our Lord, who was born of Virgin Mary, He suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried, and the Methodists said He went straight up to heaven. The Lutherans and the Catholics said He went down to hell, then up to heaven. The Jews says He ain't even come yet, let alone go. I couldn't believe anything. What's to believe about that? You got millions of people that believe one thing and millions of people to believe something completely contradictory, and they ask a fallen down, knee walking drunk, what do you believe? I believe that I'm going to go into DTs. These are the kind of things I believe. So I couldn't get that. And that's how I was going to stay alive, by getting that. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to pay tribute, and I try to do it every time I talk, to the people who I think were instrumental in this program and me getting open enough to allow God into my life through those people. It's real popular to get up at a podium, and nobody will argue with it, and say, when I come in AA, them old-timers, they taught me well. And you know, and I believe that a lot of people that say that are just like me, that they consider those guys old-timers, that were like old guys, and they were like sober 2 years or so, you know. Those guys sober 2-3 years are very important. First of all, because I remember being sober 2 or 3 years, and I remember going through tough times at that time. and thinking that I'm no use to anybody. You know, I can't. What good am I? I'm only sober a couple years. I don't know nothing. And I'm struggling. And I'm still arguing and fighting with my wife. And my job's in jeopardy now. And I'm worse off than I ever was. And it's just painful. My kids are bad and undisciplined. And it's just rotten. I wake up from being drunk now after a couple years. And I realize I hate my job. I don't know how I really feel about my wife. And I don't know what to do. And I got all this energy, physical energy. You know, you're 32, 33 years old. And you're just... wow, and you're not drinking now, and you're healthy, and what are you going to do with it? You know, you can only mow the grass once, and it's cut. And I, at that time, I'd leap into bed with her, and she'd leap out. You know? So I'm full of all this vinegar, and I was going through a bad time, and I remember those guys looking back on it. That were sober 2 or 3 years when I was brand new. They're the guys, and I want to tell you guys that are sober 2 or 3 years, you're the guys that saves the brand new guy's ass. See? Because you're still crazy. And I want to give you just a rough scenario of what I seen in those days. These guys are sober two or three years, and one of them will be sober 3 years, and he had the car. And the other guy was sober like a year and a half, and that was like his co-pilot. And if they had a woman going with him, even if it was an older woman, they put her in the middle between us two guys. They get the privilege of having a woman sit between them when they were driving, and they put the riffraff in the back seat. See? And there was always like crazy situations with all these guys. And whatever stage of their sobriety in, somebody always had something crazy going. Like one guy has like 3 crutches or something have to be stored. You know, another guy got some other, he has to bring something. Something weird, like a pumpkin or something. You got to bring something. Another guy's working on his master theory in the back seat, you know. And the son of a bitch is about ready to go over the bridge, and he's worried about this master's thesis, you know. He ain't touched it for 8 years, and now he's sober 3 weeks. He's going to get to... And I'm screaming and crying in that car because I had forgot to renew my plumbing license, and they wouldn't give me another one. And I want somebody to get a political fix so I can get that damn thing. And then all this would be going on in the car. And the guys would be having conversations. It went like this. One guy said, I'll tell you, George, if Martha doesn't come back to me, God, I'll never make it. I know I'll get drunk. And the other guy says, well, I'll get rid of that bitch I'm married to. The other guy would say, honest to God, I got to get a job. If I don't get a job, man, I can't stay sober if I ain't working. The other guy says, yeah, my job. I'm quitting that sucker tomorrow. And this craziness would go on in the car and fight, you know, and the guys would laugh and just laugh at each other. And finally, you would be so hopelessly trapped in being a jerk. And you would hear these stories, and these guys are laughing at themselves. They got themselves in serious jackpots, serious ones. And they're saying, damn it, well, I ain't drinking, you know. And... it was inspirational, let me tell you. And so I ran with that crowd, and by running with that crowd is what delivered to me. I wasn't sitting in some quiet little chapel with sun streaming through a stained glass window. I was sitting on a toilet, and it dawned on me that I was coming to believe that a power, the power in that car, the power of George and Harry and this and that, the power whatever, the power that made them work, the power that made them guys get tears in the corner of their eyes and they got dirty fingers and calloused hands and they put their arm around some guy with 3-piece suit, lawyer, and they understood each other. You know, people that would normally not mix. And just together like that, and it just made things all right. All the hates would like come off like scales, you know. I remember I had a young pigeon, and he was like in the early 80s when Pittsburgh was going tooth and nail about closing these mills and all the mill workers, and they were putting dead fish in the Mellon Bank boxes and everything. And he was in on that kind of stuff. You know, wouldn't it be that God sent him some executive from the United States Steel? I can't believe it. And they hit it off. And it was like amazing to watch the AA thing just circumvent all the other crap. What was most important was staying sober and being all right in AA. And I was part of that stuff, and I loved it. And so I started to get AA. God started to give me AA. This God I didn't believe in started to come in my life. And once I had those feelings, I couldn't do the second step. I don't know how somebody does it. It just happened. It happened for me. And once it happened, I wanted to join up here. I wanted to turn my will and my life over to whatever the hell was coming down here. What is it? Whatever it is. I could sense that I was getting some of it. And I wanted it all. And I wanted to do what you do here so that I could be part of it. And so I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of that God, whatever that God is, as well as I can understand it those days. And I did that on my knees, the way it said in the book, because I thought I might as well. Because I'll go to a meeting and they'll say, well, how do you do it? And I want to do it like they said how to do it in there, so I don't have to take any flack off them intellectuals. And so, but once I did that, now I wanted to get active. I wanted to do the stuff. I was like motivated. I could feel a push behind me to do what you do here. So I took an inventory. And once I took an inventory, I knew I had to take a fifth step, and I just had to take a fifth step. Well, I was hurting with that garbage in me. And I didn't want to tell anybody. And I knew I had to. And I would think, I'll take it with a guy real old and sick and wish he died. You know? And that's not how I did it. I thought even more bizarre stuff than that, but I ain't going to tell you. But I end up taking my fifth step. And looking back on it was the smartest thing I ever did, because it changed my whole life. It gave me spiritual experiences that I didn't have any concept of how the Spirit of God in Alcoholics Anonymous would come to me. I was so surprised with the different roads that this thing took for me. The AA coincidences that popped up. That I could talk for hours up here about the different things that were confounding things that happened to me. Unlikely good things. Just as pronounced as the bad luck I used to have. I look back on my drinking days and I remember I couldn't believe anybody could be so unlucky. I'd be out at 4 o'clock in the morning in the most poo-dunk town you ever seen in your life and just easily cruise through a stop sign. And there was one cop in Pennsylvania that was not in the donut shop that see me going through this thing, you know? And the same thing happened in reverse when I get into Alcoholics Anonymous. It just happened that the good things, and it made, you know what it did? It made my suspicions that a lot of crap was happening to me was like pre-fixed or something when I was drinking. It made me think that there was something here. I got in a bind that a lot of agnostics get into. If you get into this thing, you see, you either got to believe that mankind as a whole is no good, or there's no God, to justify the stuff. Now, what happens in AA, see? To me, anyway, that's the way I see it. These AAs do nice things, and they don't tell nobody about it. And they do things behind your back. Now, if you're an agnostic, you get into a bind where you don't know whether an AA did it for you, or God did it. Now, you can't give credit to either. Because if you give credit to God, you believe in God. If you give credit to the AA people, then you got to say that mankind is way better than you've been bitching about for 20 years. And once you start thinking mankind, you can even narrow it down with the alcoholic thinking, well, it's only AAs, it ain't everybody. Because an AA will tell you right away, well, then stick around AA, big boy. If you like it better here, don't go nowhere else. And if you think it's so good over in this part of AA, if you say something like, well, it's just the old-timers that still do that stuff. A lot of them other guys, they don't do nothing. Stick around the old-timers then. If the good, you know, they'll just narrow it down, give you what you want. They ain't just maneuver you right in. You start whining and crying. They'll give you everything you want till you beg them to stop. You know? So one of the big tricks about them AAs that they do that saves guys' lives like me is they want you to tell them. And I remember saying, I wanted to do things. I'd get nervous and restless, and I'd tell them, I want to do things. My God, I had guys getting us to do the damnedest things, stuff that I wasn't used to. I want to, you know, horse riding. I remember up my sponsors. I had this sponsor for a while. He moved away. But he brought, in the middle of January, she wanted to see this little horse. He had a colt out there. She wanted to see it, and she didn't want to go. She said, but I don't want to go outside. So he went out and put it in the house. His wife didn't like that, let me tell you, but here's this colt walking all around the kitchen. And I just said, boy, that's super, you know. And guy took us on a boat. You know, I want to go on. I said, well, I had this nice summer day. I wish I had a boat. Want a boat? Let's go up and see Jim. I get in the car. We go see this guy, Jim. He got a boat. Let's get the boat, Jim. Down the river, they go with a boat, you know. And this is a reckless driver type boat guy, you know. And I took my whole family on her. My family was happy. You know, my daughter, she was thrilled to death. Never went on a boat. I wasn't a boat kind of guy, you know. And but here we are in a boat. You want to do something today? You say, well, I want to do that, you know. Come on. You know, they'll go now. You better pack your bag. We're off, you know. And so you can't go through life bitching and crying like I used to do, and sitting in a bar still whining about not being able to do anything, because you can do anything you want. And it's absolutely spooky. And they even warn you here, don't pray for it if you don't want it. Yeah. And so these things happened to me. I got good things out of just having AA turn me around so that I could do what I'm supposed to do, so that I could make a maximum use out of what I did have. Did have a few talents and did have some ways that I could get by with. And by God, I was able to do it if I wasn't sitting in a bar drunk. We got a nice house. We had this old piece of crap with wall-to-wall bugs in it. And I thought it was all right when I was drinking. I was only sober 4 months. I told my wife, what did I look at this place? She said, I've been telling you for 14 years this is a pigsty. You know, I got tired of having old washing machines on the porch and tires and stuff, you know. Just got tired of that. And so we got out of there. Got a mortgage like everybody else up to here, you know. But that went away. All you got to do is stick around, you know. Mortgages, 20, 30 years, nothing to it, you know. Day at a time, you know. I'm going to tell you one more story and I'm going to sit down. I want to tell you that I got into the amends steps. It took me 4 or 5 years to make amends to my family. Now, my original attitude on those amends was I'd go up to my wife and say, look, honey, this is the step I'm on here in AA. And, you know, I was pretty rotten to you, and I'm awfully sorry. Well, it's her out of the way. You know? So I couldn't do that. I had to slowly do what I had to do to try to get back in the mainstream of being a father and a husband. The worst thing that I had to do, because I got in a point where I used to sit around in meetings, if I didn't enjoy the speaker, I would sit there and hate my stepfather. This was my, like, new hobby. There I am, 33, 34 years old at the time, and I'm brooding and hurting. And I got a knot in my stomach, and it's about what I went through as a child. Couldn't let that go. I wouldn't tell anybody about that part. I would make light about him being rough. And I hear a lot of the young men say, oh, my dad, my daddy, you know, my daddy kicked my ass, you know. And yeah, right, you know, yeah, macho, that's cool. Never bothered you a bit, did it, you know. And it bothered me. And I knew it wasn't popular to tell the guys, you know, that's like whining and crying. You're better off, if you're real macho, to be just like the old man in order to escape the pain from the old man. You know, you can kick the dog or something, you know. That old man don't bother me. Get out of here, Fido. You know? And so anyhow, I was laboring with that, and I couldn't tell anybody. So I'm in a meeting. Once again, and a speaker got up, well-respected member of AA, had a dynamite spiritual message. All as I got out of his talk that night was he got sober to improve his golf score. That's what I said. You know? He didn't seem to have any. He said, I had a good home life. I was brought up in a good Christian home, and my dad had $1 million, and I went to, you know, the dental school, and here I am, just struggling by with three homes. And he says, it's even improved my golfing, you know. And so normally I would have told anyone who asked me how the speaker was, because I knew in AA what to say. And somebody said, how do you like that talk? Oh, good talk. Top rate. Made me, I'll make it today over that talk. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But this night, I was hating that stepfather too much, and it was eating my guts out, and I could not say that once again. So when they asked me how I like to talk, I told them. As a matter of fact, I had to get back later on, make amends to that poor doctor, because I really, man, I went through him. And they weren't surprised, the guys that asked me. They weren't surprised at my answer. They all was glad to hear it. Hey, he's opening up. Come on over. And so these guys got around me in a circle like at this meeting, and they weren't worried about nothing else that night. They weren't worried about getting the pots clean. They weren't worried about torturing any of the other new guys that night. They were worried about this guy who was like sober 3.5-4 years. They were worried about his sobriety because he opened up instead of taking that drink. See? And they come in the way they come in. The way, looking back on it, I know today that when I have my big troubles, when I'm into my real bad stuff, that all I have to do is get a bunch of them, or get a couple of them, or one of them, and tell them the truth. Tell them how I hate God that day, or tell them how I think nothing's worth it, and then they'll love me. What they say don't mean nothing. Sometimes they say the cutest things. Sometimes they say the funniest damn things. Sometimes they say serious things, but all the time, they love you. And all the time, when I confide in them guys, the love comes out. Sometimes it comes out different. But it comes out, and I feel it, I sense it. I was trained here, and my God has opened some kind of a little thing in me that allows that AA love to shoot back and forth, you know, like synapse or something. It just flies around there, and it works, and that's what they did to me that night. They loved me into not drinking again, and they loved me into taking a step that I never thought I'd take. They wanted me to go back and make amends to this stepfather, who I thought maybe the better thing they would come up with was forming some kind of a hit squad and go kill him. The story I had as a child with my stepfather would have made any Sunday school teacher cry, because he was a brute. He was a cement block with hair on it. And I thought in those days that he took personal joy in giving me physical pain. I would not listen to him. They made me in AA take my own inventory so I'd have something to take back when I went back to Chicago, where he lived, to talk to him about this stuff. They said, you've got to deal with him. You absolutely have to deal with him, or you're going to drink and then you're going to die. The way you drink, they knew me, they knew my history of the way I was, they talked to me, and they knew all the other stuff. And they said, Jack, you got one choice, man, and that is go deal with that situation, or you're going to be back in it again. Nothing's going to protect you. And so I did. And I took that inventory of myself in that area, once again, before I went to talk to him, because they told me to, not that I thought it would do any good. I was very surprised when I sit down and did my inventory what I come up with. But as I come up with the idea that I did not give that man anything that he wanted, nothing. When he took over as being my father, I would not change my name. I got an attitude of, you can tear my ears off and stuff them in my nose, and I am not going to change my name to your name, because I don't like you. I ain't never going to like you, and you can hurt me as bad as you want. I ain't changing that name. I'll fight to the death for that. And that hurt him. He never said to me, that hurt me, you're not changing your name to mine. But he had like a fantasy about having, he was going to make me his son. He was going to do that because he loved my mother. And the way, kind of guy he was going to do that. It's my boy. That's what he was going to do. But I had to give him that much and I wouldn't give it to him. So I denied him and I denied myself. Also, I just clung on to my mother and I was going to be everything my mother needed. You don't need this guy. You don't need him. I'll do everything for you you need. If you want boyfriends, I'll go out in the street and find them. I'll bring them home, screen them, whatever you want. You don't need to step far. All you need is you and me, Mom. You work on a railroad, and I'll clean the house up a little bit, and then we'll go on nice vacations in the summer, and you can meet sailors down Atlantic City. And I'll ride the rides and have a good time. And this wouldn't work, but it was in my mind. And I hurt my stepfather with it. And I told him, I sat down at the table, I told him all that stuff, and then I told him, I said, you know, I'm in an AA, and I was sober 3 years or so. Well, he told me, he said, you've been in that, he said to me, he said, you've been in that A&A thing now. Well, I told him that I talked about him in bars. I said, I badmouthed you in the bars when I was drinking. And then I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I get sober and I give leads in AA and I badmouth you in my leads. He said, don't worry about that. He said, you're in that A&A or whatever the hell it is now for 2 years. I said, three. You know. And he said, you're no longer coming here and not knowing you're here, surprised visits to your mother, and you're walking up the steps on your knees drunk, and you're real surprised when your mother answers the door that you're 500 miles away from home. And he said, your wife's no longer calling up here and waking us up in the middle of the night to ask if you're here. He said, to hell, he said, you got out of that dump you lived there, and you got a nice house out in Manureville or whatever the hell you call it. He said, now I'm proud of you. I thought, damn, you know, he must have heard all the good things I did in AA, you know. And so I said to him, he said, I want to tell you why I'm proud of me. Why I'm proud of you. And lay it on me, you know. He said, I'm proud of you because I made you what you are today. I couldn't believe he said that, but you know what? That was the best thing he could have possibly said, because that was the answer. The guy gave me everything he could give me. I had no excuse for hating him anymore. I had absolutely no excuse. Everything he was, I didn't like. But everything he was all he had, and he thought he'd give it to me. He thought he'd give me the strength to not drink, go through life without drinking. Goddamn boy stuff. Just like I made him. I know that's how he felt. He used to say, you know, be driving nails for him, you know. He gave me shingles one time. Go up, he said, take these up the ladder. I said, how many bundles you want? He said, take three. So I grabbed three bundles of them shingles, and I could hardly get started. And what happened was I went right through the rungs. I would not drop them shingles. Man, I had them shingles on me. I'm 17, 18 years old. Jesus Christ. And I get up there and I ladder and everything. And I go, boom, boom, boom. Down through them rocks. He says, I see you broke my ladder, you goddamn jerk. You know? But that man thought that that was the most important thing in this world. And he thought he had transferred it to me, and he was proud that I had it. That I was all right now. That I'd be what he thought was a good man. Not necessarily a good man, but a man. A man that didn't take nothing from nobody, you know, and got by and kept his family and brought money in and worked overtime and didn't snivel around, you know, played hard. And hell, I know you hear on every damn talk show you hear that's the worst thing in the world. But don't forget, that's people is all they got. That's all they got, and you got it. By God, everybody got to have something. It mentions in a big book that be quick to see where religious people are right, because they've done a hell of a lot more good than bad. And I think as bad as my stepfather was, he done more good being there than not being nothing, you know, than walking away, because he fought the thing, fought it. And towards the end, it ain't like him and I was going out and fishing trips together or something. I'm not telling you that. I'm just telling you that it was all right. That we could have eye contact after that, and I could see the pride in his eyes, and he liked to see me come. And I didn't come that often. And I didn't stay that long, but I came. And we shook hands and talked a little bit about the job and all that stuff. And my mom told me, he used to brag. And when he retired from the railroad, I got him, anybody, railroaders would be familiar with this. I got him a T-shirt, and I had it written on there, "Retired Railroader, Do Not Hump." And he said he'd walk through, anybody's a railroader, and he'd walk through the mall. He said, a lot of them young railroaders, you know, them young men, and they'd come up to me and say, "By God, old man, that's a hell of a T-shirt you got there." You know, and he'd go around bragging about how I give him his T-shirt. And you know, in the meantime, it was all right, because that ball of hate that was in my stomach that was killing me and blocking my spiritual achievement in AA went away. It just went away, brother. I'm here to tell you that. If you got one of them big lumps in your belly and you do what them people in here tell you to do, it's going to go away. It went away for me. And I became one with AA, and I became comfortable the first time in my life because I belonged. I never, ever had that feeling of not belonging again since that time. And that is sustained, you know. And I went on to the point where I could get down on my knees and thank God. And I got to the point where good things had happened to me, the hell, I don't deserve. I don't deserve good things like this. I used to, you know, I would take my wife down to some greasy spoon where they had topless waitresses at night. They'd put a blouse on for the afternoon trade. And I'd take her to places like that to eat. And now, through none of my own efforts, I'm coming to a beautiful hotel like this with swimming and friends and good meals. My wife bought a dress for it and everything. And this is a different life. This is a great life that was given to me because I don't belong here. I belong in front of some pinball machine down in the worst section of town, you know. And here I am. And I owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor, God, you people. God bless you and thanks.